So I want you to imagine just for a second trying to compress your entire family history into a single evening of entertainment.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a nightmare, honestly.
Right. Like not just the polished highlights you bring up at Thanksgiving, but absolutely everything.
Yeah, all the messy stuff.
Exactly. The quiet resentments that build up over decades, the sudden strokes of luck, the changing times, bitter arguments at the dinner table that somehow redefine your entire worldview.
Yeah.
You have exactly one evening to make an audience who knows absolutely nothing about you understand all of that.
I mean, it really sounds like a fool's errand.
Yeah.
You're taking this massive multi-generational web of messy human lives and trying to force it into a very rigid, highly structured box.
Yeah.
Something is inevitably going to break or just get left behind, right?
And yet, that was the exact, nearly impossible task handed to the creators of the 2009 stage musical adaptation of Edna Ferber's classic novel, Giant.
Which is just a massive undertaking.
It really is. And welcome, everyone. I'm your host, and today we are taking a deep dive into the Wikipedia article detailing this monumental theatrical production.
I'm the resident expert here, and I'm super excited for this one.
Same. We are going to explore how creators take unwieldy, sprawling source material and distill it into a structured, impactful experience.
Which is a skill that applies to so much more than just theater.
Oh, totally. Think about the massive projects you have to synthesize at work or the complex historical events you try to wrap your head around. The underlying skill is exactly the same.
Absolutely.
We're looking at a creative team, specifically, Music and Lyrics by Michael John Lacusa, and the book by Sybil Pearson, who attempted to do this with a story that most people thought could never, ever work on stage.
It's just a fascinating case study in artistic ambition.
Right.
And it is crucial to note right up front that they based their work on Edna Ferber's original 1952 novel.
Right.
They very explicitly did not base it on the famous 1956 film.
Which is a big detail we'll get into. But, before we even get into how this musical actually sounds and feels, we have to understand why it almost never happened at all.
Yeah, the backstory is wild.
Right. This wasn't a project that Lacusa and Pearson just dreamed up on a whim while having coffee in New York. The origin story actually goes straight back to Edna Ferber's own family.
That's right. Her great niece, Julie Gilbert, was the catalyst for the whole thing.
Okay.
She actually approached Michael John Lacusa about 5 years before the musical eventually premiered.
5 years.
Wow, it was a long road. She essentially pitched him the idea of turning her great aunt's magnum opus into a stage musical. She really believed there was a theatricality to the book that had never been fully explored.
But Lacusa's initial reaction, along with his collaborator, Sybil Pearson, was basically absolutely not.
Yeah, a hard pass.
They literally thought it was impossible to stage. And, when you look at the source material, you can see why.
Oh, definitely.
The novel covers decades of time. It features a giant cast of characters, and the backdrop isn't some contained little parlor room in London.
Right.
It is the wide-open, dust-swept, seemingly infinite landscape of early 20th century Texas.
I mean, you are dealing with an epic in the truest sense of the word.
Yeah.
How do you capture the infinite horizon of Texas on a traditional framed proscenium stage?
It's just a box.
Exactly. It's a physical space that naturally limits how much you can show. Furthermore, how do you age a dozen characters over 30 years while maintaining a cohesive narrative
Yeah.
without relying on constant disruptive costume and makeup changes? It is a logistical nightmare for a live performance.
Okay, let's unpack this. They eventually say yes, and the Signature Theater commissions Lacusa to write it.
Right.
But they make that crucial decision early on to base the musical strictly on the original novel, deliberately rejecting the classic 1956 film starring Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, and James Dean.
Which is a huge choice.
It is, and here's my question. If you are trying to adapt a story, it's like trying to adapt a 1,000-page historical textbook into a pop-up book.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. You aren't just deciding what to bring, you're deciding which pieces of your life you're willing to cut off.
Yeah.
So why is it often necessary to bypass a beloved, culturally dominant movie and go back to the original text? Didn't the James Dean movie already do the hard work of summarizing the book for them?
Well, it did summarize it, but that is exactly the problem with using it as source material for a new adaptation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Original texts, especially novels of this scale, contain the complex, granular details that movies inherently have to smooth over to fit a tidy 2-hour runtime.
I see.
The film version of Giant is a masterpiece of cinema,
Wow,
obviously.
no one's denying that.
but it changed a significant amount of the plot to make it work for Hollywood sensibilities in the 1950s. But going back to Ferber's novel, Lachiusa and Pearson were deliberately choosing the harder path.
They wanted the difficulty.
They wanted the friction, yeah. The unpolished edges and the deeper thematic resonances that the movie just, you know, sanded down.
They wanted the raw material, not the prepackaged version.
Precisely. It allows for a much richer stage adaptation because you aren't doing an impression of a movie. You are translating the raw emotion of the original author directly to the stage.
That makes sense conceptually, but it brings up a huge physical problem.
Uh-oh.
Because they chose that denser novel, they suddenly had to engineer a theatrical structure and a musical score large enough to hold it all.
Right.
You can't trap an audience in a theater unless the narrative and musical engines are strong enough to pull them through it. Which brings us to the premiere at the Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia in 2009.
Yes.
Directed by Jonathan Butterell, this production was entirely unorthodox.
Unorthodox is putting it mildly. The structure of that premiere defied almost every modern theatrical convention.
I mean, the original runtime for this premiere was 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Yep.
Spread across 3 acts with 2 intermissions.
Which, just to give you some context, is practically unheard of today.
It's a whole shift.
It really is. Almost all modern musicals are strictly 2 acts with 1 intermission, clocking in around 2.5 hours tops. A 3-act musical in 2009 is a massive demand on an audience.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I have to push back on this.
Okay, go for it.
A nearly 4-hour runtime, 3 acts. Isn't that just hostile to a modern audience?
Yeah.
I mean, you're breaking the cardinal rule of respecting people's time and attention span. You're asking people to essentially give up half their day to sit in the dark. At a certain point, isn't that just a failure of editing?
What's fascinating here is how form follows function.
Okay.
Yes, it asks a tremendous amount of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But that wide-open runtime was a deliberate artistic attempt to mirror the wide-open landscape of early 20th century Texas.
Oh, wow.
You cannot capture the feeling of the endless, exhausting Texas plains in a brisk, punchy 90 minutes.
I guess that's true.
Furthermore, it mirrors the sweeping timeline of the story itself. The creators wanted the audience to physically feel the weight of the years passing.
By trapping them in the theater.
Basically, yeah. By making you sit there for nearly 4 hours, you feel the endurance and the generational shifts right alongside the characters. It's an immersive endurance test.
So the exhaustion is part of the aesthetic. I can see that, even if I wouldn't want to sit through it on a Tuesday night.
Right, it's a lot for a weekday.
But to fill that runtime, Lachiusa had to create a deeply diverse musical palette. To pull off a Texas epic, you can't just have standard Broadway tap numbers and jazz hands.
Definitely not.
You need a score that actually sounds like the geography. The sources tell us the score required various distinct musical styles. We are talking acoustic Mexican folk, country, rock and roll, jazz, mariachi, and even soaring operatic pieces.
And they don't just exist side by side, they collide.
What do you mean?
Early in the show, the music is very traditional. You hear acoustic guitars, Mexican folk songs sung by the vaqueros, sweeping orchestral strings to represent the untouched plains.
Very natural sounds.
Right. But as time passes and the landscape industrializes, the score violently shifts.
Ah.
Suddenly you have aggressive jazz, loud brass, and rock and roll drum beats drowning out the acoustic instruments. It's auditory whiplash.
The music itself is industrializing. The score is aging along with the characters.
Exactly. The transition from acoustic to mechanized sound physically makes the audience feel the passage of time without a single line of dialogue needing to explain it.
But a fancy score can only take you so far. The narrative itself had to carry the heavy weight of decades of social and economic upheaval.
Yeah, the story is incredibly dense.
Let's look at the actual story taking place on stage because it's driven by a fierce collision of values. The story kicks off in Texas in 1922.
Setting the stage.
Right. The core conflict orbits around a few central figures. First, you have Jordan Bick Benedict, played in the premiere by Louis Cleal. Bick is a rich, deeply traditional cattleman who runs a family ranch called Rieta.
Which is essentially the size of a small country.
Bicycle, yeah.
Then Bick marries Leslie, played by Betsy Morgan. Leslie is an outsider. She is from Virginia,
yeah.
A place of refined old world manners. And she is thrust into this harsh, unforgiving, male-dominated Texas environment.
Talk about culture shock.
Totally. She is essentially the audience's surrogate, entering this bizarre new world.
And then there's the wild card, Jett Rink, played by Ashley Robinson.
Oh, and Jet.
Jet is just a handyman working on the ranch, but he represents the ruthless future. He eventually discovers oil, becomes obscenely wealthy, and harbors this deep, lifelong infatuation with Leslie.
So immediately you have this profound thematic clash. Mm-hmm. It is old wealth, represented by Bick and the generations of cattle ranchers, battling against new wealth, represented by Jet and the booming dirty oil industry.
But it is not just an economic clash. It is a profound cultural and social clash.
Yes.
The narrative heavily relies on the bigotry and racism exhibited by Bick and his older sister, Luz. Luz is fiercely protective of her land and deeply against outsiders.
Very set in her ways.
Right. And their prejudice is specifically and aggressively directed against the Mexican-American population in Texas who do the grueling labor on the ranch.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the plot.
Now, I need to pause here for a second. We want to be very clear with you listening.
Yes, absolutely.
We are impartially recounting the plot of the 1952 novel and the 2009 musical.
Okay.
We are exploring the narrative tension. We are not endorsing any of these viewpoints or taking political sides on the content.
Exactly. It's important to look at this strictly as a dramatic tool to hold a mirror up to the harsh realities of 1920s Texas.
Right.
The creators are using Bick and Luz's historical prejudices not to make a modern political endorsement, but to accurately reflect the incredibly fractured social hierarchies of the era. The stage is acting as a historical document.
Right. The tension has to be authentic to the time period for the eventual payoff to matter.
Yeah.
As the story ages the characters over the years, which they achieved theatrically through changes in posture, darker vocal tones, and shifting lighting rather than just painting wrinkles on their faces.
Which is a cool technique.
It is.
Yeah.
We see how these deep-seated prejudices cause fractures within the family itself. Leslie feels completely alienated by Bick's worldview. She realizes the man she married is clinging to a dying, exclusionary way of life.
The ultimate generational shift, the breaking point, really happens with their son, Jordy Jr. He grows up and falls in love with a Mexican woman named Juana.
Wow.
Meanwhile, Leslie has spent years quietly working to help the marginalized Mexican-American workers on their land, providing medicine and education.
Right.
Ultimately, over the span of decades, Bick is forced to confront his own hardened worldview. He has to choose between his archaic pride and his own family, and he finally comes to accept his son's choice.
If you look at this structurally, it's brilliant. This family's micro-level drama is pulling double duty as a macro-level history lesson.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, mm-hmm. you see exactly why they felt they needed those three acts. The cattle versus oil debate is the literal story of American industrialization.
Yeah.
And the bigotry, the resistance, and the eventual begrudging acceptance within the Benedict family is the story of shifting societal norms in the 20th century. Real change, both industrial and social, doesn't happen overnight in a neat 2-hour window.
No, it doesn't.
It happens over decades of slow, painful struggle.
So we have a 4-hour musical dealing with systemic racism, the birth of the oil industry, the death of the cattle barons, featuring a score that ranges from mariachi to rock and roll.
It's a lot.
That is a heavy meal for a theater goer. A story with this much thematic weight is bound to provoke strong, divergent reactions. How did critics and audiences actually digest this theatrical behemoth when it premiered?
Well, the critical divide is fascinating because almost everyone agreed it was a work of genius, but they violently disagreed on whether it was actually watchable.
Really?
Yeah, the reviews were mostly positive, but heavily hedged by concerns over its daunting length.
On one end of the spectrum, you had absolute, unvarnished raves. Terry Teachout, writing for the Wall Street Journal, gave the production an unqualified rave.
Yeah, he loved it.
He called it the most important new musical to come along since The Light in the Piazza.
Which is high praise, but he went even further.
Yeah.
He stated that Lucky Yusa and the composer of Piazza, Adam Gettle, were the two most prodigiously gifted musical theater songwriters to come along since Stephen Sondheim.
That is massive.
In the theater world, comparing a living composer to Sondheim is the ultimate coronation. It means your work is complex, emotionally resonant, and musically groundbreaking.
But then you have what I would call the enthusiast critique. Peter Marks of the Washington Post praised the score, writing that Lachisa wrote some of the lightest, most dramatically compelling music of his career.
Right.
And he praised Sybil Pearson's libretto, which is the actual spoken text and narrative structure of the show, for bringing potent Lone Star characters to the stage.
But Marks included a very specific warning label. He noted that at its epic length, the show becomes an advanced placement sort of musical.
I love that phrase.
It's so good.
It implies there's prerequisite knowledge required. It's like you better have done the assigned reading, brought a notebook, and had a strong cup of coffee before you sit in this audience.
Exactly. It assumes you are willing to do the work as an audience member. It was geared more for the ardent, hardcore theater enthusiast than the casual entertainment seeker looking for a light night out with tap dancing sailors.
But on the far end of the spectrum, you had much harsher pushback. The reviewer for Variety acknowledged the inventive score, but they called the show humorless and, at times, incoherent.
Ouch.
Yeah. They pointed out that there were choppy, unconnected scenes, especially in the dark third act where the timeline speeds up.
And they had one specific glaring structural complaint. They were furious about how the show handled its climax.
Oh, this is the best part.
Pivotal highlights, most notably the life-changing oil gusher that transforms Jet Rank from a dirt-poor handyman into an oil baron, were presented only in retrospect.
Meaning,
the massive, sky-high oil strike happens entirely offstage. The audience never sees it.
Wait, I have to stop here. They took the most iconic visual from the James Dean movie, the image of him standing under a geyser of black oil raining down from the sky, and they just didn't show it.
Nope, they didn't show it.
They just had characters walk on stage and say, wow, did you see all that oil? That sounds like a terrible theatrical decision.
A lot of people agreed with you.
The Variety reviewer argued this robbed the story of its needed spark and alienated anyone who wasn't already intimately familiar with the novel. So what does this all mean? When experts disagree this sharply, when one critic is calling it the next Sondheim, and another is complaining that the biggest, most exciting plot point in the entire story happens in the wings, how should we evaluate its success?
This raises an important question about the very purpose of deep, complex art. Is the goal of a musical adaptation to provide a streamlined, visually spectacular summary of the plot?
Maybe.
Or is the goal to force the audience to sit with the difficult internal reality of the subject matter?
Mm.
If you believe art should be a neat, entertaining package of special effects, then an offstage oil gusher is a failure.
Sure.
But you have to remember the limitations and strengths of the medium. You cannot put a 100-foot exploding oil derrick on a wooden stage.
Right. It would look like a cheap theme park trick.
Exactly. So instead of showing the spectacle, theatrical creators focus on the human reaction to the spectacle. Leaving the physical oil strike offstage forces the audience to focus entirely on Jet Rank's psychological transformation and how Bick and Leslie react to this sudden, violently acquired wealth.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
If you believe art should challenge you and focus on intimate human reactions, then it's a masterful design choice. It's the difference between watching a flashy fireworks show and watching a gritty documentary about the people who build the fireworks. Both are valid, but they require entirely different mindsets from the audience.
That is a perfect analogy. The history of the show's development following that 2009 run actually reflects this exact ongoing battle between epic, uncompromising scope and audience digestion.
Yeah, they couldn't keep doing the four-hour version forever.
Following the signature theater run, the creators held a reading in New York in 2011 with director Michael Greif.
And that reading led to a major co-production between the Dallas Theater Center and the Public Theater in 2012. Now, here's the crucial detail. For the Dallas production, the creative team finally relented on the structure.
They did the painful work of editing.
They did. They rewrote the musical, trimming it down from three acts to a more traditional two acts with a single intermission.
They finally killed their darlings. They realized you can't keep people in the theater for 4 hours if you want the show to survive.
It was a necessary compromise to give the show a future beyond that initial advanced placement crowd. And the discipline paid off. The musical eventually premiered off-Broadway at the Public Theater in New York in late 2012.
That New York run featured some incredible heavy hitters, including Kate Baldwin as Leslie and Brian D'Arcy James taking over the role of Bick.
Such a great cast.
And it found real industry validation. It received 8 Drama Desk Award nominations, including Outstanding Musical, Music, Lyrics, and Book.
And for anyone who wants to experience that vast musical landscape Lacusa created, to actually hear how acoustic guitars give way to industrial brass, a 2-disc cast album was released in 2013. It captures the entire sweep of the score.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, let's bring it back to you. Whether you are trying to master a vast new field of study, preparing to tackle a massive multi-departmental project at work, or just trying to understand a complicated piece of history, The lesson of Giant is that immense scope requires structural ambition.
Yes, absolutely.
You cannot capture a sprawling landscape in a tiny frame without losing the essence of what makes it real.
The takeaway is that you shouldn't be afraid to take your own deep dive into the denser, messier original source material of whatever you're studying.
Yeah.
Relying on the abridged, smooth-over movie version might save you time, but going to the original text gives you the nuance and the friction. And friction is where the real learning happens.
It is about having the patience to sit through the complex, difficult acts of whatever challenge you are facing. Because at the beginning of this deep dive, we asked you to imagine trying to compress an incredibly dense, multi-generational family history into a single evening.
Still sounds like a nightmare.
It seems impossible, but sometimes the attempt itself yields something extraordinary. Which leaves us with a final question for you to mull over as you go about your day.
Let's hear it.
If you had to adapt the sprawling, messy, multi-generational story of your own family's last 30 years into a two-act stage production, what major oil gusher event would you be forced to leave off stage?